welcome to the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zachary Elwood. This is a podcast about understanding human behavior. To learn more about this podcast and my work, go to peoplewhoreadpeople.com. Let's say you get pulled over by a cop. The cop would seem to have a lot of power over you. He wields authority, he carries a gun, he could theoretically make your life very hard. But then again, you also wield a lot of power over him. For example, if he does something wrong, you could report his behavior and get him in a lot of trouble. Depending on what he did, you could even ruin his life. So what is this concept of social power? Who has power over who? Is such a thing even possible to define and quantify in such a complex system as humanity? Today I talked to Elisaveta Friesen, who thinks and writes about media and social influence. She's the author of the book Media is Us, and I interviewed her about her ideas back in 2021. In that book, she made the case that we shouldn't think of media as something out there, some external force that exerts control over us, but as just another manifestation of the interaction of human minds, in a similar way that talking in person is a manifestation of human minds interacting. I thought that was an important point as it tied into how I was thinking about political polarization. That we too often reach for blame of systems and institutions when those systems and institutions are just a bunch of people doing people things. In this episode, I talked to Elisaveta about social power, which refers to the power that people hold over other people. Topics we discuss include the ideas of the philosopher Michel Foucault, which are often referenced in liberal-leaning academic circles. And apologies, I mispronounced his name at the start of the interview. The oppressed versus oppressor framework, which is frequently referenced by liberal people these days. How simplistic views of social power can be divisive and result in a reduction of people's empathy. Elisaveta's ideas on social power. How the free will debate ties into these ideas. And by the way, you might enjoy listening to the last episode before this one, which is a talk with a physicist about free will. I think the ideas Elisaveta and I discuss are important. They tie into so many discussions these days. For example, they often come up in the context of American divides, as you can hear some liberal people speak about Republicans as if they're oppressors, and as if social power is some simple, easily defined element. And this language is often heard in the Israel-Palestine debate too. It's heard in a lot of places. I'll include some links to things we talk about in the entry for this episode on my site, peoplewhoreadpeople.com. You can learn more about Elisaveta's work by going to her website, elisavetafriesen.com. If you want to search for her online, her last name is spelled F-R-I-E-S-E-M. Okay, here's the talk with Elisaveta Friesen. Hi, Elisaveta. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me again.
Yeah, my pleasure. So maybe we could start with, it seems like I think a lot of people think that Foucault's theories of power, human power, are rather simplistic, and that they basically, people think that they describe someone having power and then someone not having power. But in your work, you've talked about the complexity that Foucault actually brought to the discussion, that his work was more complicated than that. Am I getting that right, that there are a lot of people who think that's what Foucault's work said, that there was a, you know, basically there's power here and then the people without power over here?
Well, first of all, I need to clarify that I don't see myself as a Foucault specialist. I read a few books and I read a lot about him. And I chose one part of his writing, one part of his theory that works well for me to explain my own ideas about power. So I wouldn't speak for other people. I think other people might actually have more complete understanding of Foucault's work as a whole, right? But I find his ideas very insightful when he talks specifically in this book called The History of Sexuality. The first part, there's like one section that he introduces this idea of power as not a binary, not a binary relationship. And that's what I find especially important for my own theory of power.
Mm-hmm. And you got into being interested in this. Did it come about through your interest in the media examination? Am I getting that right?
Yeah. I mean, I have background in philosophy. My first doctoral degree was essentially in humanities and social sciences. And I started in a college of philosophy back in Russia. But then I came to the U.S. and I studied media and communication. And then I started noticing this connection. I mean, I saw a lot of people using postmodernist ideas and Foucault's ideas to explain society's problems, and specifically problems related to the media. And so then I started thinking more and more about it, and I wrote the book, Media is Us, Understanding Communication and Moving Beyond Blame. And we talked about this book about a year and a half ago, right? Or was it 2 years? 2 years and a half ago. Oh, wow.
Maybe yeah, two. Wow. It's been a while, yeah.
Yes, on this podcast. And as I was writing this book, I just realized that I need to talk more about power, because I read a lot of scholars discussing society's problems, which I think is a very important thing to discuss, obviously, because society does have problems and some people are disadvantaged and suffer. But then they were discussing it through the lens that I identified as a lens of blame, sort of dividing everybody into somebody who suffers and somebody who causes suffering just by default. And I just felt that something was wrong there. Like personally, I felt that I wanted to dig deeper into that. And that's when I remembered how I studied Foucault back in Russia. Mm. And he had this idea that power is like a flow. He said power is like a flow that is
everywhere,
just running all the time through society. And it's not something that anybody owns, but rather that something that influences everybody's actions. And it does sound kind of strange. And I'd be like, what exactly was he talking about? Mm-hmm. But I felt like it might help me explain what I wanted to explain when I wanted to say we need to go beyond that blame. Mm-hmm.
Right. And in a recent blog post of yours on your site, you talked about many people's kind of simplistic idea of power, like, you know, there's a king and there's a peasant, right, as a common example of, you know, a power, somebody having power over somebody else. And could you talk a little bit about what you wrote in that post and how you saw more complexity in that dynamic?
You're referring to a page of my website. And so I have a website that I specifically dedicate to exploring power as a paradox, as opposed to power as a binary, which I see power as a binary. This is a common perception. So we see, you know, we consider that some people have power and some people lack power. Or power is something that you can clearly say, okay, well, I have it or I don't have it, and the other person has it or doesn't have it, right? And I wanted to explain how it's more like a paradox, that it's something that you can have and lack at the same time. And so I thought that this example with a king and a peasant can describe it well, because, well, first of all, I wanted to take an example that is sort of detached from the modern debates, because I feel like whenever we use examples from controversial issues, then very soon people just stop listening because they're sort of feeling very strong emotions about those issues. Mm. So I feel like king and peasant is something that is like further removed from our everyday life, but also a very vivid example, because you can think of a king as somebody who has absolutely power over this peasant, right? So king has power and can do whatever he wants, and the peasant has zero power. And I mean, he makes some choices in his everyday life, you know, where to, like, I don't know, when to harvest or whatnot. But then, you know, if the king decides to send soldiers to arrest or kill the peasant won't be able to do anything, you know, this sort of relationship. And so I wanted to explain that when we think about power as a paradox, it's not like we're saying, well, a king and a peasant have the same amount of power, or, you know, it's not like the king has power over the peasant, but the peasant has the power of the king. So, like, you know, kind of reversing this relationship. So this is just turning this simplistic binary around. It's true that king in many situations has more power than a peasant. Like a king can make a law and then a peasant has to obey this law, for example, right? If we just focus on this relationship, it's fairly clear who has power over whom. But it's not like this is the only relationship in the world, right? There are other relationships. There are a lot of people around the peasant and around the king.
And there's many peasants and only one king too. There's like, you know, it's...
Well, in a specific country.
So that's
another thing. So if we look at those other relationships, we start noticing that things are not as simple because, first of all, the king was born to be a king, right? And he doesn't necessarily chose to do, you know, things that are expected of a king. So, and I mean, now it's kind of might sound kind of vague, those examples, but I can give some life to it. And I've been actually researching life of Louis XIV, because I thought this could be an interesting figure to dive into. And I'm now working on a page about his life and based on a very extensive book that I read written by a historian. And so there are plenty of examples to show how Louis XIV, well, with all the power that he had, he also lacked power in many ways. You know, he became king when he was 4. And then as a child, he didn't have much power at all. Like he was pushed around and he needed to follow different ceremonies. And he was used as a pawn in political games of his relatives and parents. And in general, like living in a royal family in a court was tough. And this all is not to say that, you know, he had it worse than a peasant. And obviously a king like Louis XIV, I don't think he ever experienced hunger, for example, you know, but there were a lot of things that he couldn't control, right? He wanted to control desperately because he was told, you know, he was born into this meaning of like absolute power and he was told that he's supposed to have it. But throughout his life, he had many instances when he couldn't use power. You know, he had to do what other people wanted him to do or expected him to do. And then and he had to live according to, you know, this idea of monarchy that he didn't invent, the expectations for what it means to be a king. And those expectations, if you think of it, were created before him and supported not just by him and embraced by everybody in France and in Europe of the time. So in this sense, you know, peasant does come into play because believing, you know, in the monarchy, believing in the power of religion that gave the king the divine rights to do whatever he wants, supposedly, right? That, you know, everybody in his kingdom played some part in that. Although obviously people did criticize them and dislike him and some people, you know. So that's where it gets complicated.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, you're saying to some extent these systems around us, the systems of social interaction or whatever are outside of any one person's control. It's like, it makes me think of, you know, I think of a lot of people's mind, like Trump, you know, set what Trump does or says, you know, sets the, you know, his supporters just follow along. And I think, you know, in that context, you can see it's much more complicated because, you know, for example, when Trump was trying to take credit for the vaccine, so he wanted to, you know, tell his supporters that this was a good thing. We did an amazing thing. And, you know, his supporters at that rally booed him, basically. And I think he got the, you know, he got the message, well, there's a limit to, you know, what I can get, you know, even my enthusiastic supporters to go along with, right? It's like he and anyone is a part in this system that is not fully in their control, right? And I think, would you say that's an example of what you're drawing attention to there?
Yeah, I think it is a good example. And I think that, well, there's this very good book that if you didn't read yet, I recommend. It's called Strangers in Their Own Land. So she wrote it around the time when, like a little bit before Trump was elected. And there's towards the end, she explains his popularity, right? You know, like he was at the, you know, right time in the right place sort of thing, you know? So of course, it's not like it's nothing about what he did, right? But it's also something about the circumstances that were there and are there that, like you said, like allows him to remain popular among some people, well, I guess a significant amount of people.
The idea of power is complex. I think in our first talk, we talked about the cop citizen example in modern times where, you know, in a lot of people's conception, it's like, oh, the cop has a lot of power, but the cop has power in one context, like in the in-person interaction, but the citizen can have a lot of power after that interaction. Like they could, you know, they can clearly like file a lawsuit and destroy the cop's life if, you know, if the cop does something wrong. So it's just drawing attention to these sometimes kind of simplistic ideas we have of like there's different types of power, there's different power in different context, right? And especially for a society where, you know, you have more recourse for unleashing your power in various ways.
Yeah, definitely. That's another good example. Yeah, certainly you can take any example where, you know, people say, well, clearly there's a power imbalance. And I would be like, yeah, there is an imbalance on one level, but on some other level, things get complicated. And that's where my own theory comes in, which I call theory of micro and macro power. Mm. And the goal of this theory is to show how we can at the same time acknowledge that there are some imbalances and inequalities, and at the same time deal with them going beyond blame, right? And using empathy. And empathy comes when we understand that even people who in those micro situations clearly have power, when you zoom out and look at the macro situation, you see that they don't choose the world where they operate. They don't choose the ideas that dictate their actions. They mm-hmm. And you think they choose their worldview or their, you know, decisions and desires, but you know, and there's an element of choosing, right? And we can talk about that, the free will part. Mm. All right, but there's a lot of not choosing. Let's put it this way.
Uh-huh. Right. Yeah, and I get the impression that some liberal people, you know, especially the more far left activist type people, it seems like they can resist the idea that power is complex. I feel like, and I'm not an expert on, you know, how standard this is across academia, but it strikes me that a lot of people have a sort of, they communicate a simplistic idea of power, right? In the sense that it's like, these people have power, these people do not. And I think it seems to me like the reason that they may resist the idea of power being complex is because it can strike them as a blame the victim type of thing. Like they can, but by implying that, you know, people can basically play a role in their own oppression in some sense, that can seem offensive to them, even though, you know, as we stated, it's like clearly there can be bad things that people do and people can be oppressed, but it's like the idea that the power dynamic is complex can seem offensive. Do you think I'm getting, is my perception accurate, do you think?
Yeah, I think definitely the blaming the victim, that's a big no-no, right? And I'm believe me, I'm spending a lot of time thinking how to phrase my ideas in a way that they don't like I'm blaming victims. Mm-hmm. And my whole theory, like that I describe right now, it's to go beyond that, to show that there are victims, there can be victims, and people can suffer. And you can say like, hey, this person hurt that person. And at the same time, you can say, hey, but the person who did the hurting, like it's more complicated there. So, but there is this danger, like I'm always concerned that people can interpret that as like, oh, so now you want to, instead of empathizing with the victim, you want us to empathize with the perpetrator. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, I guess you could put it this way, but that's doesn't have to be a bad thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's what's so hard. I mean, I spend a lot of time in my, you know, in my depolarization work trying to think about how to best phrase some of these similar concepts, where it's like, you know, trying to understand the dynamics and how like the systemic dynamics of like, you know, the more contempt people show, basically the more you're creating a dynamic and environment where like the most polarized people have more power, you know, and trying to see the very human nature of a lot of these things, even for people we may very much dislike or find dangerous. It's like people can be very challenged or offended by the idea that we can have empathy or try to understand, you know, the human aspect for these people we think are bad and dangerous. But I think that's, you know, that's an important part of lowering toxic polarization or just understanding, like you're doing, understanding the dynamics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, and I realized I was saying his name wrong. It was, as you said, it Foucault is the proper pronunciation.
Well, he has so many letters there, you know, French spellings.
Yeah, it's the French thing threw me off. So I think, and many people have criticized his ideas as being pessimistic and dark, in the sense of like, I think kind of painting this portrait of people's kind of a cynical portrait of people using power and structures of knowledge to, you know, to control people or oppress people, whether they were doing it intentionally or not. Do you see his ideas? And I know you said you're not an expert, but do you see some of that some of his ideas are kind of pessimistic about human nature?
Yeah, I think they're pessimistic because, well, again, maybe there's somewhere that he wrote something more optimistic, but as far as I know, he focused on problems and he focused on how power is hurting people and creating issues in everybody's lives. Mm. And I don't think he had this suggestion anywhere, but I might be wrong, right? That, oh, this is what you can do to get out of this unpleasant situation. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, one of the things that stood out to me was when I was just doing a little bit of research on his work, and you know, he painted scientific knowledge as another means of, you know, social control, that knowledge, and he used the example of like madness in the 18th century was used to stigmatize people who might not have just fit the ordinary mold. It was a means of control in his description of his theories. But you know, I guess that can be a way that it could be perceived as really pessimistic, because you could also, you know, see those people as like they weren't trying to do that. They were, you know, many of them were probably trying to help people that they thought were, you know, unhappy and suffering and such, you know, even if Foucault might think that there was some underlying, you know, systemic society thing about control.
He has this important theories related to power and knowledge, and also in the book that I mentioned before, History of Sexuality, he talks about sexuality and people's perception of sexuality and relationship with sexuality through the knowledge and how about it, you know, what is a good, you know, sexuality, what is a bad sexuality. And for him, obviously, that's was very relevant because he was homosexual himself. Yeah, again, to repeat myself, yeah, I don't think he had any or pointed out any silver lining. I think mm-hmm. he mostly talked about the problems.
Right, yeah. And I could see why people think of him as very pessimistic, because it's, you know, when I read some of his stuff, it was like, it's not how I I mainly look around and think, like, most people are trying to do what they think is a good thing and trying to help people, even if, like, you know, I think they might be very wrong. But yeah, I can see why people interpreted his writings as being very dark. You'll now be hearing an ad. I don't endorse these ads, and I encourage you to remain skeptical of all ads.
If you know what Lila stands for, then this podcast is definitely for you. Two besties since middle school turned moms and psychologists chat the good, the fun, and the yucks of life.
We're tackling all things mental health, from our own personal self-esteem to losses like friendships and parents, as well as addiction. Many things us midlife mamas are going through, from our own personal experiences with our added professional flair.
We hope each week our listeners feel like they just left a good old therapy session with their bestie. We'll dish tips and tricks to help keep your mental wellness in check and hopefully make you giggle a time or two.
Be sure to check us out each Monday and meet your life's newest cheerleaders, Sarah and Jen, with the Lila's Podcast.
Yeah. And that I try to overcome this in my own work, where I say that, well, we can have hope. We can, there are some things within our power, although we might be powerless in many ways, but I think we can make choices that eventually help us to improve things for everybody. Right. But again, you know, I acknowledge also that that's my own perception, my own bias, if you will, right? So I don't know which one is, you know, better or more accurate, you know, the being pessimistic or being hopeful. But I want to be hopeful.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and it seems like there's so much complexity too in the realm of human power. There's so many types of ways to influence people, right? It's like, I think a lot of times with these examples, people think of physical force, but then there's like persuasion. You know, we clearly try to do, when we try to change things in society, we try to use persuasion a lot to change people's minds. There's, you know, there's sexual seduction, there's negotiation, there's all these various ways that people can exert various power over people. And I'm curious if that's something you've thought much about, or if Foucault talks much about that, if you know.
Well, that's where I don't use Foucault for that part. On my website that I mentioned, that is dedicated to power specifically, and the name of this project is Power of Meanings of Power. I've been working on it for about a couple of years, and it's structured as a hypertext, which basically means that I have a bunch of pages, and then I try to explore different ideas related to power and show connections between them. So the page about Foucault that you mentioned, it's on that website, and what I'm writing about Louis XIV, that's another part of this website. And yet another part is where I'm trying to analyze power and show its different types and forms, right? What you've been asking about. And what you mentioned, I classify more as power as influence. The division that I came up with so far, and it might change or I might make it more granular over time, is that there is power as ability. So because we could say, like, well, I have power to, you know, lift like a heavy stone, right? Or I have power to realize that I, you know, see everything as horrible today because I'm tired. You know, that's an ability that I can develop, and it's also a kind of a power, right? Then there is power as influence. So as a power as ability is more like resides in us, right? Our properties. Then there's power as influence is about interactions with others. I think I write in one place on this website that it's good to connect it to the idea of limited resources, because when there are only so many things in the world and only so many things that so many ways that things can be, right? When somebody can decide how things should be, right? Or who should have things, like, they influence the way things are, right? Or they influence other people. So there's power as influence. say if there is an apple on the table, there's one apple and, you know, I get to eat it. So in this particular, and you wanted it, but I got to eat it, right? So in this particular situation, you can say that, you know, I influenced, you know, the situation and I got, you know, and I influenced you because you didn't get the apple and I got the apple. Yeah. Mm. You know, so, and then there is a power of, like, I call it May power, which I don't know if it's a great idea because it sounds like a month, but I meant like power, like the permission. Like some people are allowed to do some things, but others are not, for example, right?
Oh, and what was the word you said?
Made. You know, like may I do that?
Like, oh, in this question, okay,
like,
gotcha.
You know, uh-huh. I don't know if I'll keep this word. So basically, I started noticing how, like, all of the things we call power, you can see those different types and forms of power, which doesn't mean that they exist separately. Like me being able to do something also is connected with me influence other people, or, you know, the ways things are in the world. And me being allowed to do something is related obviously to other people, because who allows me is like other people allow or not, or they don't allow. So it's all this division is very artificial, but it's for the purpose to show that there are all these different forms, like this, we things that we call power. And in each one of those aspects, we can see elements of power, like what I can do, and elements of powerlessness. So I guess, like, I created this theory that I described earlier about micro and macro power, about sort of society existing on different levels, right? There is this very specific level of interactions between individuals, and it's easy to say that in this relationship, who has the power over whom, right? But then we zoom out and then it becomes more complicated. And I know this might be kind of difficult for people to wrap their mind around this, like different planes of social reality, sounds kind of fancy. So I tried to boil down, like, what am I trying to say here in my theory? So I decided that the easiest way would be to say that power always coexists with powerlessness. Mm. So if you look at those different aspects of power, like, I mean, I'm saying, like, in take a specific person and look at them, like Louis XIV, you know, and look at these different aspects of power throughout his life. And you'll notice that he had power, but he also had powerlessness. And so you can take mm-hmm. any other person and notice the same thing.
Yeah, there's certain things they can't do.
Yeah, you know, like the Louis XIV, like when he was around 20, he fell madly in love with a niece of the cardinal of the time. And he really wanted to marry her. And his mom, his mother, king's mom, his mother and the cardinal told him no. Like, he was devastated, but he couldn't do it. Mm. He had to marry the niece of his mother because of the rules of dynastic marriages. Like, the kings had to obey. They seldom married for love. You know, there's just one example.
I've been watching some of The Crown, and that's, you know, that show about the British, you know, monarchy and their families. And it's like that so much of that is about the limitations, you know, that they're kind of trapped in this system, right? Even as, like, many people would perceive them as having a lot of power. That's just another, that's a good show about that kind of dynamic. It seems like reading your work and talking to you previously, it seems like a lot of this work leads back to the question of free will. Am I getting that right? And have you increasingly delved into the free will, the sticky, horrible, confusing topic of free will?
Yes, I. Well, to tell you the truth, for a while I wasn't thinking about it a lot. I was just thinking, you know, about this power, the term power, and thinking about how, when we have it, when we don't have it. And then I think it's actually thanks to you, you brought me back to this idea of free will. I certainly knew about this whole debate, and I learned about it when I was studying back in Russia, in the College of Philosophy, you know, because it's a big philosophical debate. It was kind of here and there in the back of my mind. But then when we were talking during the our previous conversation 2.5 years ago for the podcast about my book, Media is Us. And you said you don't think that people really have free will. And I was like, I need to think about that. And I did think about and I listened to your podcast, the other podcast, the interview with this really cool
scientist. Daniel Whiteson, yeah.
He's a physicist, right?
Yeah.
And he wrote the book, We Have No Idea, which I read and I loved it, mm-hmm. about how little we know about the universe. So in this podcast, you talked to him about free will. And so I listened to it and I thought more about it and I read more about it. And I realized that actually my theory of power is just like another way of talking about free will, essentially, right? Because, you know, if we say that we have having free will equals having power, you know, not having free will equals not having power. And as I said, I came to the conclusion that essentially power always coexists with powerlessness. And to translate it into the free will conversation, it means that, yeah, we don't have free will in many instances, but in some instances we do. Or, you know, or, okay, maybe a better way to say it, our, you know, the debate about free will, it's debate about determinism, like our actions determined, and if so, how much they're determined by factors outside of our control. So my theory, basically, to translate into the terms of this free will conversation, is saying that determinism is true. There is a big part of determinism in our lives, but there is also an element of free will. And I, you know, I'm a philosopher, so I'm not going to give you precise numbers and tell you, like, we have, you know, in our life, we have like 95% of determinism or 50% of determinism, and then the rest of it is free will. So I don't know. I don't know if we can ever answer this question. And that's why it's a philosophical question, because to answer this question, we would need to, you know, take a specific person, say you, right? And then consider all factors like in your life, all and everything in the world, essentially, because it can could have influenced the way you are now and the way you live your life now, like things in the past, you know, from the beginning of the universe, essentially. You know,
yeah,
and we need to consider everything, and then think, well, okay, does Zach still have free will in this? You know,
well, yeah, it seems like any philosophical question about people leads back to the whole free will concept eventually. Like, if you follow it back, it's like that's kind of like the fundamental human mystery, right? It's like we're a part of a system. We're part of a physical system. We're made out of physical things, you know, leaving aside any religious, you know, spiritual questions. Let's just say, you know, if we believe we're like a physical system, we're in a physical world with things around us. It's like, you know, we can see that, you know, the argument that there's no free will because we're just like an unfolding of physical things. But then it's like you bring in consciousness and, you know, the feeling that we have free will and that we clearly can, you know, change things. However we do that, that mystery of human nature, I feel like, you know, Foucault's work, your work, you know, it's like, it's kind of like tackling this fundamental human mystery of like us being part of a system, but also feeling like, you know, we have agency, how, you know, whatever that agency is. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. As being part of the universe, you know, like in general, and with a bunch of different systems, you know, we're part of.
And I think, you know, even for when you said, you know, it's like you think for your theory, you think that there's some, you know, whatever it is, percentage of free will. But it's like, I think you could also frame it as like, you know, there's like the system aspects and then there's like the human individual agency. And then like, you know, maybe you could view that as like some form of agency, even if you don't believe in free will. It's like that unit of the person is having some impact. You know, what, even if like you didn't believe at all in free will, it's like you could theoretically like separate the individuals from the overall system, if that makes sense. I was just trying to formulate it in a way that, you know, would make sense to somebody who didn't believe in free will at all.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't think actually that talking about impact helps, because you could say that you know, say like a person comes to me and punches me in the face, like, you know, they had an impact over me. I didn't like it. I have a bruise now, right? So, but then it turns out that they have a mental illness, you know, so that their action was determined by their mental illness. So you're kind of looking, you know, the impact, just the looking at the impact doesn't tell us anything about what happened there. Like, you know, King can have immense impact on people around him. Doesn't right. mean that there's no element of power and powerlessness there.
Right. Yeah, true. Yeah, well, you don't have to tell me because, you know where I stand on that stuff. And and for anybody listening, if they want to listen to talk about free will, it's not to say that I like am a firm believer that we don't have free will. It's more just like I find it unlikely, but I find life so mysterious, it wouldn't surprise me if we have free will. So anyway, I just don't want to sound like I'm like really like overly certain on that idea or something. So one thing that struck me about your work and the idea of power is that it seems to get at some really root debates in the political polarization sphere. You know, for example, the conservative and liberal philosophies. And one thing I see there is I feel like, so for example, in our, you know, in our political landscape in America, for example, conservatives philosophy, it's often framed as putting the emphasis on the power of individuals, right? Like they focus on, you know, the individual has a lot of power. We should let them do what they want. Whereas liberalism is more associated with putting the emphasis on the ways that, you know, people are influenced and controlled by their environment, and we can try to, you know, produce better outcomes by shaping their environment and helping them, etc. And it seems to me like in the sphere of the political polarization, those two ideas have become kind of unreasonably polarized because, you know, you have some people speaking as if humans are like, you know, completely free creatures that aren't influenced by the things around them, you know, on the conservative side, and are offended by the idea that, you know, there could be systemic influences on them that help explain their behavior or could help influence their behavior. And then on the liberal side, sometimes there's this offense that a seeming offense that of the conservative idea that the focus on the individual's freedom. And one example of this is, you know, that I think it's unreasonably polarized because if you go to a therapist, for example, they'll try to make you see the importance of taking responsibility for yourself, for being a person with agency. They'll try to help you escape the idea that, you know, your problems are the product of your environment. I mean, you might be able to see those things, but the idea is to get you to be more at cause and less at effect. And that's kind of like where I see, you know, I think all of us have a sense that both of those things are true, that we're both a product of our environment, that things led to the way we are and influence us. But yet we also have this agency to control the environment, however that happens, you know, leaving aside the free will debate. So that's where I see kind of like an unreasonable polarization. And I think that like the more reasonable, less polarized way to view it is like, yes, both of these things are true. Like, you know, and that kind of helps us see the arguments on both sides, you know, of kind of some of these political debates where people are coming from, because you can view both of those things as true. You know, it's kind of like the getting back to the fundamental mystery of being a person, right? It's like we're influenced by other things and yet we can do a lot, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm curious is that something you've thought much about?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't be able to speak for conservatives because, full disclosure, I do identify myself more as a liberal. So I am aware about a lot of ideas that are on the conservative side, but I'm not, my environment, you know, people I interact with a lot are liberals. So I can, it's easier for me to speak about what I observe in that environment. Mm-hmm. So, and in that environment, it's interesting that you made this. I can certainly understand why you're saying that conservatives, for them, the idea of individualism is big. Like, you know, it's your responsibility. Say, if you're poor, you know, it's your responsibility, kind of, you know, thing. I think it's easy to see associate conservatism with this vision is, you know, if you didn't pull yourself
rugged by individualism.
Yeah, like if you didn't pull yourself by your full bootstraps, like it's your fault kind of thing, right? Mm-hmm. And for, you know, I'm sure there are people out there on the conservative side who say things like that, right? So, but speaking about liberalism, I actually see both of the ideas that you just mentioned represented there, but just mm-hmm. really in applied to different people. And so the idea is like, okay, so we have people who are oppressors and people who are oppressed. Again, no, not everybody phrases it this way, or people who have power and people who don't have power, and, you know, marginalized, not marginalized, and dominant. Or so the people who are suffering, who are disadvantaged by the system, the idea that I encountered is it's important to acknowledge that those people, their decisions, their life, their worldviews are determined by factors outside of their control. And that's why we should empathize with them and help them. And even if they make some mistakes, say, you know, if they commit crimes, it's because of their environment. And I agree, you know, with that, you know, because it's true that if you are born in, you know, say a poor neighborhood and you grow up with gangs and, you know, and that's the life that you know, and you might also choose this path. And even if you make mistakes, really big mistakes, you still need to be able to get the second chance or whatnot, right? Mm-hmm. So that's when it comes to people who are suffering, who are marginalized, in the mind, again, as I see it, of people in the liberal community, that's how people who are marginalized are perceived. But then we take people who are from the dominant groups or powerful groups, and then for them, it's a different standard is applied. So those people, they are individuals. They make choices, and they are fully responsible. And that's why we shouldn't really empathize with them. And that actually, I remember when I was doing my second doctorate degree at Temple University in Philadelphia, and I had this professor that was a great professor. I learned so much from this professor. But I remember I had this conversation with them that really puzzled me, and I thought about it for a while. And we were talking about, you know, gender relationships and inequalities that certainly do exist. And I said, well, the way I see it is that there are some expectations and assumptions related to gender, and that they affect both men and women. Like both men and women suffer from those limiting assumptions. And the professor said, yes, that's true, but men have power to change it, unlike women, because they are in power. They are the powerful group. Women are not the powerful group. So it's up to men to change the situation, even if they suffer. And I didn't say anything because I needed to think about it. And I did think about it for a long, long time. And I thought, well, I don't agree with that. Like it's
too simplistic a framing.
Yeah. And that's why exactly, like, that's one of the conversations that sparked my ideas about power and that the theory of micro and macro power that I mentioned already in this conversation. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, it makes me think of this conversation I had recently with Yaakov Hirsch. It was about the Israel-Palestine conflict. And but that was the, you know, on a deeper level, it was about how when we feel animosity towards people, when we're in conflict, we really lack empathy for the people on the other side who we see as, you know, doing bad things or abusing their power or whatever. So it reminds me of that because I think, you know, to your point, it's like one thing that comes to mind is people on the left who will basically insult rich people and act like they're just, you know, clearly horrible people just because they have money and, you know, and it relates to this kind of lack of empathy we have where, you know, even from a functional standpoint of like, what is insulting them do? There's a lack of empathy, which leads to insults, which leads to, you know, a lack of caring maybe on the rich people's part where they're just like, well, if I'm going to be insulted by people, like why, you know, why would I help? And it's like leaving aside the fact that like, clearly there are rich people who do good things, and, you know, wouldn't you want to encourage them to do the things you want them to do? So it kind of reminds me of this lack of, you know, this lack of empathy I think people can have when they are in a, you know, in a dynamic where they feel the power is imbalanced.
Yeah. When we think about, well, somebody, you know, they created the situation, they keep it going, you know, it's they need to change it. It's their fault. So this is this blame, you know, dynamic that I want to help more people see beyond, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and it sounds cliched and spiritual like to say, but I mean, I really do. The way I think of people is like, they're just me in another form. I mean, like, mm-hmm. I could just as easily be them. It's just a happenstance of, you know, chaos and randomness that they're them and I'm me, right? It's like, you know, I don't know if that's how you feel.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting way to put it. And I think sometimes this way, I mean, I don't literally think like they are me or I'm them, but I'm thinking, you know, how can I judge somebody if I don't fully understand their circumstance? If I were born in their place and grew up in their environment, like when we blame, we assume that free will is almost absolute. Like they chose to, this, you know, doesn't matter what kind of factors are out there influence them. Like they made those choices. But I'm thinking that there are all those circumstances outside of their control. And if I were them, then it was very possible that I would have made those choices that they're making and I might be disliking. So it's not about saying, oh, what they're doing is okay, you know, and so you brought up the example with rich people and said, well, some rich people could do good things, right? But some people do things, some rich people might do things that are, you know, are hurting other people, but it's still not a reason to be like, well, they're evil or they're bad people. And it's not the same as saying what they're doing is okay. So there's this excuse conflation that I heard in a person doing a really meaningful work around polarization saying, I think his name is Robert Wright.
Robert Reich.
I can send you a link later. But basically, like, you know, that we, when we are explaining somebody's behavior, it's not the same as excusing it. And same, you know, you can bring up a more famous figure is Martin Luther King. He was certainly very much for, you know, fighting against inequalities. And over the years, he became more and more adamant and like more vocal in his calls for resistance. But he, at the same time, till the end of his life, he was committed to the idea of nonviolence, which is essentially the idea that you can resist and you can fight and but you don't have to do it through mm-hmm. contempt or hate. You know, violence doesn't just breeds more violence, and hate mm-hmm. just breeds more hate, kind of.
Yeah, I think it so much relates to the political polarization things, because, you know, it's trying to separate the contempt we feel for other people from the disagreements we have with other people. And I think seeing other people as part of a system and being like yourself and having empathy for them, even as you may think that they are very wrong or even very dangerous and bad, it's like, I think it results in a better way of engaging with other people. And I see that as very mm-hmm. much related to the depolarization work of, you know, reducing contempt. Yeah. Is there anything? Oh yeah. I want to ask you, it seems like from my perspective, you seem to be in an interesting space of work, because like you said, you were politically progressive, as I understand it, but your work also questions some common dominant liberal ideas in academia. You know, for example, in your book Media Is Us, you started out that book with a story about some false distorted news from in mainstream liberal leaning media that was making the rounds about specifically it was about an allegedly racist Dove soap ad, and you learned that it was a distorted framing and basically a wrong framing of it, and you started the book out as a way to talk about the media failures that we perceive and that can make us angry sometimes and that we blame the media for. That's just one example, and then your work in the power space is also kind of questioning some what I think are, you know, simplistic ideas about power in the liberal academic space. And I'm curious, is that how you see your work? And do you feel like you'd get more notice for your work if you weren't pushing back on some of these ideas, or how do you see that?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of different factors at play, and I consciously chose to do my work outside of academia because I like to, there are a lot of limitations for doing scholarship in academia. Like you need to choose your field and you need to publish in certain journals and a certain amount of things and write things a certain way. It's certainly well-intentioned and it makes sense because you do want to be able to focus on some issue and like dig into it, or you want to be able to have good publications, or they need to be structured in a certain way. But for me, it didn't work, right? And I like jumping between disciplines and ideas and drawing ideas from different sources and practices. Like, you know, like I think about Martin Luther King, but then I connect him to the practice of mindfulness and meditation. You know, I think about like philosophy and sociology and media and I can apply this to, politics and parenting and the art and everything. And I want to be able to just be free in like what I write and how I write. So I decided I'm just going to do it on my own through this hypertext that I mentioned before. So, and I'm also, honestly, I'm kind of very afraid to go out into the, you know, social media, and you know yourself that there can be very unpleasant conversations happening there, mm-hmm. right? And where people might misinterpret me and I'm unfortunately very sensitive to that. So I'm like, okay, I'm just doing this on my own and sharing it little by little. And, you know, I'm really grateful to you for giving me the opportunity to share it with more people in this very helpful, like friendly and supportive space of this podcast, is I think it fits perfectly the work that I'm doing. So, yeah, but, you know, then you can ask, like, why am I afraid? So it is connected to, you know, what I'm observing, like that I do think that people, some people would not be very receptive to this whole idea of like empathy for everyone and, you know, and trying to talk to people across divides. And you know it perfectly well from your experience, right? And you said that you feel like you're losing some readers or listeners, you know, if you...
Yeah, the more polarization-related things I do, the more, for the podcast, the lower the viewership or the audience gets. Yeah,
so it's a, and I'm sure you had conversations on social media where people would, like, accuse you or attack you.
Yeah, lots of hate for that stuff. Yeah.
You know, you see, so there's certainly something to this, you know, your assumption that my ideas, you know, might go against some, I don't know, dominant ideas or people's feelings. I don't know if it's necessarily just in academia or in more general, the cultural climate. So it does go. I feel like it does go against some of those ideas.
Well, it's kind of like the whole power conversation. You know, it's like if the system isn't ready for your ideas, you know, or anyone's ideas, they won't be boosted, right? It's almost like the systemic qualities of like, well, if the system changes in some sense, and then you would have your ideas and you would have more power, but you kind of, you know, I was just thinking of the systemic element of like,
well, yeah,
you know, there's a limit to what you can do. You're dependent on the system and its overall vibe. Yeah.
Yeah. And the system, and I just wanted to say, like, because the system sounds very like cold and abstract, like systems, just like, you know, other people,
the network of people,
people doing stuff, understanding things a certain way, doing things a certain way, organizing their practices a certain way. And and here's like again where we can bring it to the idea of free will and say that, you know, it's not just like, okay, well, I'm powerless here and I don't have I don't have like a free will to use in the situation and to change the system. Actually, I feel like that's what gives me a boost to keep doing what I'm doing, because I feel like there are actually people out there like you, you know, and other people that would be interested and would be receptive and might, you know, benefit from my framing. And if I'm doing what I'm doing and they're doing what they're doing, you know, like that's how, you know, that system that you mentioned changes over time. So it's
right.
So, and that's why I keep doing what I'm doing.
Yeah, that's kind of, you know, reminds me of when I wrapped up my Diffusing American Anger book, which is honestly like way too bloated. And I know that it's like way too long, but I ended with thoughts about, you know, the fundamental conflict of that paradox of like, you know, I do believe people have a lot of power. It's like, I feel like you, me, other people have a lot of power because, you know, that sometimes that people can clearly change things. They have an impact. Right. And it's like the fundamental paradox of like, yeah, I can feel that way at the same time as feeling like I or other people are part of this physical system of whatever it is, and feel like I don't think free will is likely, but at the same time feel like, yeah, I can do things. Like that's kind of like the fundamental paradox of these ideas. Right. But, maybe that's a good place to wrap it up in case you had any other, any other thoughts.
No, it is a great place. And that's why I frame my scholarship writing as trying to understand paradoxes of power, because I think it is a paradox, and it is very difficult to talk about, partially because I think that our human language is just not meant to not meant to discuss those things. It's either too simplistic and then I find myself like repeating myself, like say using the same words, or you know, like if you try reading Foucault, like you'll probably like fall asleep on the third paragraph because it's so convoluted. But he does have some interesting ideas. Like if you reread him like several times, you might get somewhere, right? So like you said, that's my take on it is like I have hope. I want to have hope. You know, maybe that's my like part of how I'm using my power is that I'm using it to hope. And I think that one thing that I realized about power is that power is always has something to do with making an effort. Mm-hmm. Like if something happens to you, like if just like, you know, breathing, like you're breathing in and out, it's not a power because like you need to, that happens to you, otherwise you die, right? Mm-hmm. Right. But if you learn to control your breathing to say influence your mood and calm down, this becomes a form of power. So you put an effort, and empathy is an effort, you know. And so I make an effort, and sometimes it's really hard to hope that we can get somewhere, and that we can eventually make the world a better place for everybody. And that's why I keep doing what I'm doing.
That was a talk with Elisaveta Friesem, last name spelled Friesem. Her website is at elisavetafriesem.com. If you enjoyed this talk, you might like that previous talk I had with her back in 2021 about her book, Media is Us. You might also enjoy the talk about free will, which is just before this episode. This has been the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zach Elwood. You can learn more about it and learn how to support my work at peoplewhoreadpeople.com. I've got a book coming out soon about America's toxic polarization problem called How Contempt Destroys Democracy. You can pre-order that now on Amazon. Thanks for listening. Music by Small Skies.